Off we go. So what's your name, please?
Tony Tai.
And where were you born?
In Oxford Street Hospital, Liverpool, same as John Lennon.
And when were you born?
1951.
A good year. And what did your parents do for a living?
My mum and dad ran a fruit and veg stall in St John's Market, in the city centre. Three generations of Thais we had.
So were you ever lumped in to help out there?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I mean, my memories of the very old St John's Market, which I think they closed down in 1964. So I can remember working there, particularly at Christmas time, and opening wooden boxes of tangerines and stockpiling them ready for the Christmas Eve. Because you'd take a week's takings on Christmas Eve. And I used to sleep in the banana boxes. In those days, the banana boxes were wooden with straw in. And I used to often sleep as a kid, probably a 10, 11-year-old kid, sleeping in the banana boxes. And it was funny, in later life, we actually found a funny spider from God knows where, which we took to the Liverpool, there's a hospital.
Tropical school.
Tropical medicine.
Yeah. And where did you go to school?
St Edward's College in West Derby.
Okay, thanks very much. How long have you been supporting Everton?
Well, all my life I had my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was the most biased Evertonian the world has ever seen. And my family, it's a split family, Catholic and Protestant. And my mother's side were all Orange Lodge, and my father's were all devout Catholics. And when my mother came in and said to her father, "I've met a lovely man, would you mind if I married a Catholic?" He said, "As long as he supports Everton, he can be anything."
And that also answers the question of why Everton. Obviously, yeah. It's the family.
It was just a family thing. And I can remember, you know, when I was possibly about 11 years of age, going with my grandfather and my father to the game, and being in the park end stand, and my father would always shout out, and it was totally out of character to him. He'd always shout out things, and I'd get embarrassed. And it's funny because I go with my 13-year-old son to the game now, and when I shout out things, he gets embarrassed. So I know exactly how he feels.
So that would have been around 62 then.
Yes, I think so. I think even before, I always thought my first game was when I was about six, so it was about 1957. But I can remember regularly going in the early 60s, just before we won the championship in 63.
So can you remember the problems with the deep freeze then? That terrible winter, wasn't there, where there were so many postponed?
There was. It was interesting because obviously we had the bad snow this Christmas. And I was actually on crutches because I'd had a hip operation and couldn't get out of the house. And there was one or two days that my son couldn't go to school. And I said to him, "Do you know what? There was only one time of all my years I was at school." And of course, it was that winter you refer to that we got sent home from school.
They don't make them like that anymore.
No.
What's your favourite player of the past?
Alan Ball, without a shadow of a doubt. Actually met him. I went to a Stoke away game. It must have been about 1969, and I used to go with a load of guys from the Stafford Morton Youth Club in McGull, and we used to go in an old Bedford Dormobile, and we used to get Meltonian shoe whitener and put Alex Young, Alan Ball, Johnny Morrissey on the side of the van, and we'd go to all the away games. And this one away game, it was that winter you refer to, and it was really snowy, and there was a delayed fixture. And I was in the stands, just in the, not in seats, and suddenly a bottle hit my ear, and it split all my ear open. So I had to go to the St John's ambulance men, and they took me away, and they took me down the players' entrance and into the first aid centre. And basically threw a glass of water over it and put an elastoplast on my ear. So I'm walking out just as the Everton players were coming out in drips and drabs, and I remember Gordon West coming out and Howard Kendall, and then I saw Alan Ball, and I said, "Alan, can I have your autograph?" And he said, you shouldn't be in here, and told me off. So, and of course, in latter years, just before he died, we became great friends because he did a lot for me for the Everton collection. He did his last dinner here in Liverpool, and I told him that story, and he was a hero of mine. He still, to this day, I've got an oil painting of him in my office, and I've got a framed of that great 48 sheet poster that Everton did when Alan Ball's quote, and it said, "Once Everton has touched you, no other club is the same," and he was my hero.
It's really good to hear that the hero worship transposed into a good meeting, because you hear so many people that say, "I'd never want to meet my heroes because just in case he's not the person I want him to be."
Well, it's interesting because my son, I was out for dinner with my son the other night, and he said to me, "Who would you rather meet, Alan Ball or John Lennon?" Because I'm a big John Lennon fan. And I said, "Oh, Alan Ball." Alan Ball, because he was the one.
And I believe your last memory of him is him calling out for you.
Jim Buckley said this. Jim Buckley told me that. He came up to Tim Buckley and said, "Where's Tony Ty?" Because obviously we were organised this dinner. We had the... we put on a dinner that was the former players of Everton and the former players of Barcelona, and there was a dinner the night before for 350 people here in Liverpool, and he gave a speech that night, and I've always loved his speeches, and he gave one that night, and I'd never heard it before, and it was sensational and inspiring, you know, about if you've got a sporty son, make sure you get him there, you know. It was fabulous, and that's my lasting memory of him.
Oh, what a nice memory to take.
Yeah.
Who's your favourite manager of the past?
David Moyes. the only manager that I see as an Everton manager is Harry Kattrick. He was, to me, Mr. Manager. And it's funny because obviously I've got to know a lot of anecdotes about him in the past, and I don't think he was that nice a man. But of course, in the 60s, he was the boss of Everton. So I always regard him as a manager, and I never regarded Howard Kendall as a manager because I always looked on him as a player. I remember when he joined Everton, and I remember coming off the bus after his first game, and I got off the bus at McGull and saw him driving through, and he had a blue Jaguar Mark II. Who's going through, and I saw him, his pale blue Jaguar, on his first match against Everton. So no, I never regarded him as a manager, and of course now David Moyes is younger than me, 20 years younger than me. So Harry Kattrick will always be the number one manager.
I heard a story going on to that player's dislike of him, which of course as a kid that never came through.
Yeah, no.
And
well, he was the boss. Was the boss, and I think there was a lot more respect then than there is now, because the difficult thing now is for managers that the players are earning more money than he is, and that's ridiculous.
Yeah, apparently one of the players who didn't get on with him at all was seen at his memorial service, Harry Kattrick's memorial service, and someone came up to him and said, "You know, the last person that I would have thought would be here to pay respects." He says, "No, I'm just making sure he is dead."
I always remember the match at Goodison for Harry Kattrick once he died, and this mysterious object came on a stretcher. I think it was the Harry Kattrick game, and this huge body was brought on a stretcher, and blanket went back, and he got off, and it was Gordon West.
What's your most memorable Everton match?
Oh, without doubt, probably 95% of everyone is going to say the same is Bayern Munich. That game was just fabulous, and I suppose everyone says the same thing: 53,000, 350 Germans, and the rest Scousers. I think we had three rows of people. We'd all gone from St John's Market, and we were all there that night. And of course, we were getting beat 1-0 at half time, thinking, "Oh, this is it. This is the end." And then when those goals were scored, I can remember we were just jumping up with elation. And one of the lads, his teeth fell out as we'd scored, I think, the third goal. And we were jumping up, and we were all jumping over his teeth. And he was saying, "Where's my teeth? My teeth!" You know, as that last goal went in. But without doubt, that was the best game ever.
Whereabouts were you sitting?
I was sitting. Funnily enough, I was sitting exactly where my season ticket is this year, because I've just changed it for next year. I'm going back to where I was for 14 seasons in the extended director's box. But now I'm in the Joe Mercer for last season, behind this huge post, and that's where that's roughly, because obviously the ground was different then. I think there was only the was it the 200, 300 club and the 500 club.
That's
there,
right.
Then.
Yes.
Yeah. But no, we were all there. Three rows of us. It was hilarious.
I was in the old park stand. What a night.
Yeah.
How do you? What's your impression of how the match has changed? You know, from when you started going. You know, things like obviously ticket prices are astronomical in comparison, and but programmes, half-time food, or fan behaviour, all this sort of stuff.
I think I used to cringe sometimes at Everton when the racist chants used to come out. I mean, I was embarrassed, and embarrassed when people said, "Oh, we're a racist club." So that's a good thing that's changed. I can remember in the early 70s, once I'd left university, I went to live in Spain. I was in Spain for 4 years, and I remember lying on my terrace, desperately thinking of a steak and kidney pie and a bovril, longing for it. And again, obviously, I've been very lucky the last 16 years. I've been in you know, corporate seats. But for some of the games, we, thanks to Everton, we don't get our seats for the European games. So the guys I go to the game with and my son, we just get normal stand tickets. And it's great to have a meat pie. And I remember the Florentina game, my son, with a meat pie on his knee saying, "Dad, this is great."
Sometimes it's the simple things that are the best.
Yeah.
How has the ground changed?
Well, I can remember the main stand being built. I can remember the park end stand being built. I can remember singing from the Gladys Street, "We want a roof on Gladys Street." But in the main, it hasn't changed much, and that's why we like it. Of course, for my teens, I was on the 6-yard line in the Gladys Street for many a year. And it was funny because last season for the Malaga game, my son was, because he's always been in the corporate side, he was desperate to go in the Gladys Street. So I took him into the Gladys Street for that Malaga game. And within 5 minutes, there was a fight three rows behind us. And I thought, God, I thought that all that had gone. And how you could have a fight at a friendly, you know. But I think it was because someone was swearing, you know. And I think Everton had encouraged kids. I think it was only £1, the entry for kids. And there was a guy swearing, and the guy said, "Would you mind, my daughter's with me?" And that's how it kicked off.
Did you ever go in the boys' pen?
I did go in the boys' pen. I did. Oh, dear me. I can remember going in the boys' pen for a famous Man United game in the 60s, and I must have been 14. So I was on the edge of not being... I shouldn't have gone in the boys' pen. And I can remember coming out and actually being beaten up by some Man United fans. And thank God some Evertonians came in and dragged them off me. But yeah, I mean, I must have shouted something untoward. But yeah, I can remember being beaten up just as we were leaving the boys' pen. So I've never been in there since.
Can you remember how much it was to get in?
Oh, no idea. What was it? Well, I can remember the Gladys Street being 20 pence to get in. Well, decimalisation was in 71, wasn't it? So I must have still been in the Gladys Street in 71. But no, I've no idea.
I can remember it being 6 pence to get into the
6p.
boys' pen.
You could have got a bag of chips
six
for that.
6d, yeah. Yeah, 4 shilling for the Gladys Street and 5 shilling for the paddock. Do you have any match day rituals?
No, not really. I used to always play golf on a Saturday morning, and when the vice president's suite was, he had the option of either dining or not dining, and it really suited me because because I'm in the corporate world, I don't usually like the corporate approach. And the only reason I go in corporate seats is the better seats, and if I can afford them, I'll pay for them. So I like playing golf in the morning, and then from where I live in Knutsford, it only takes me half an hour to get to Goodison, and then just get there. But the only ritual we have is after the game, when I buy my son a badge for every goal Everton scores. He's got hundreds and thousands of badges. God knows why I do it.
He's lucky he can still stand up.
Yeah.
What does the derby mean to you?
The greatest passion. Yeah. It means if we get beat, the worst feeling in the world. Not reading the newspapers, not going home and seeing match of the day. If we win, such pride, such joy. I can remember when Dan Gosling scored last season. Oh dear me, it's just such pride. And I'll go home and I'll watch match of the day, and then I'll watch football first, and then football first again, and then go to sleep, wake up in the morning, watch match of the day again, and watch football first again.
It's such a difference, the difference between victory and defeat.
Yeah.
It's such a long street, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
What's the furthest you've ever been to a match?
Sporting Lisbon.
Yes.
Yeah, Sporting. I ended up going to Lisbon twice last year. What a beautiful city as well. And the atmosphere on the first one, when we were playing Benfica, the night before the game, was truly fantastic. It was like Bayern Munich again, that feeling. And great being, having blue blood, and everyone there being, the pride of being a blue was fabulous, until we got to the stadium. We were doing okay at 1-0, I thought we were still in it, and then it was a disaster. And it was, and particularly the second game, that was the worst journey home I've ever had. I think on the first one, I was actually on the team plane. But definitely the worst journey I've ever had home was that second one against Sporting Lisbon. Mm.
It's the price of being a fan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you got a favourite away ground?
Favourite away ground. I can remember going to Leicester City's old ground when Andy Gray was playing, and bunking in once, jumping over the turnstile. I can remember going to Nottingham Forest for the famous Ian Storey Moore game and not being able to get a ticket, and outside the ground at 3:05, and then some live wire Evertonian put his arm in, lifted all these tickets off a spike and threw them up in the air, and we all got in. But I'd have to say my favourite ground is probably Bolton, because we all seem to win. I don't like going to Man United, and I detest going to the Onion Patch.
Do you have any... A lot of people say that they've got a liking for White Hart Lane because of its similarity to Goodison.
Yes, the old Archibald Leach stands. In fact, I took my son down there for the Purple Shirt game last season. And funny enough, was on the front row of the director's box with Andy Burnham.
Yeah.
And we had a very enjoyable... I went down, I took the boys from Liverpool United down in my car and drove down. And yes, I can remember when I was at university actually going to White Hart Lane, when they did have the Archibald Leach stands on. But I mean, I think they've got plans to move away from that stadium now. And I think the stadium is sensational. It's a nightmare to get out of. Once you get out, if you've gone down in the car, the last two occasions I have, it's like an hour and a half to get out the car park. So it's a nightmare to get away from. But it just shows you what you can do with good planning. And it shows you what Goodison should be like. That is exactly how Goodison should be like now. And if Goodison was like that, I mean, it looks like we're going to be staying at Goodison forever now, thank God. But if Goodison was like that, I don't think anybody would want to move.
Have you ever been to any internationals?
Football-wise, I've been to more rugby internationals, because obviously I played rugby on leaving school. And I've been to a few rugby internationals, but I've only ever been to one football international, and that was England versus I know not who at Old Trafford when Wembley was being built. And I took my son, and I have to say, it was the most boring game of football I've ever seen in my life. It was 0-0, an England game. I think it was Steve McLaren, probably. It was atrocious. It was awful. And I thought it was a good idea, the international team, the England team, going round the grounds. Yeah. Because, you know, why should we always have to traipse down to Wembley and play on that horrible pitch?
Have you any recollection of the 66 World Cup games at Goodison?
Well, the famous one. One of my pals was a ball boy for that game, and I can remember seeing it on Goal, you know, the film. That famous, you know, North Korean game with Eusebio. That's the one I always remember. And the other one was, the other memory of that 66 international World Cup year was the way Pele was battered and had to go off. And that's the two recollections I've got. I also recall sitting down and watching the Argentina game with Ratin when he got sent off. I can remember sitting down with a nice pot of tea and cheese and tomato sandwiches that my grandmother had made, watching them there.
You would have been, what, 15 then?
Yeah, 15 I was, yeah. I actually went down to Wembley in 66 on that same bus I was telling you about, the blue bus, and stayed overnight. I remember my ticket was sewn into my trousers. So I went down with all the boys from the youth club. My father and grandfather went down together. And my father had just bought a new car. And you won't recall, but I've got a model of it. The car of the year that day was a Vauxhall Victor Estate, which used to be all white, but the roof was red. And that was the colour swatch, it was the in colour. And to go down to Wembley, my father had it painted blue.
And this was for the FA Cup final?
For the FA Cup final, yeah. Which I think was it the 7th of May? Or the
I don't know the
5th,
date.
7th or the 15th of May, yeah.
It would have been fairly early on, because to fit the World Cup in, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I can almost hear heckles rise before I ask this question. What would you think of a ground share?
Well, I think it's the only solution. In all honesty, financially, it's with a clear business head on, I think it's the only solution. I mean, I would love a Merseyside stadium, 70,000 seater stadium, with Goodison Road and Gladys Street, and Anfield Road and the Spion Cop. And I just think that would be fabulous in Stanley Park. And it's what we should have. And to put our city back to being the capital, in the football capital of Britain. But that's the head. My heart says no chance.
If we may move on to the Everton collection, because you obviously had a huge amount influence on the collection, huge involvement in it. Could you just talk through those early days of the how it came about?
I got a phone call from Lord Granchester, who said, can I meet you at my golf club? And he was saying, listen, there's this David France collection, and the club aren't doing anything about it, and I'll come back to that in a minute. And could we do anything? What would you think if we formed a trust and tried to buy it? So I said, yes, John, that's a great idea. Not thinking what was in store. But I think John must have got into Keith Wyness's ribs, and Keith Wyness was the CEO of Everton at the time. Much maligned, I think they called him Beefy, didn't they? And Keith Wyness was absolutely 125% behind the Everton collection, and it didn't get the recognition. But the three of us, Granchester, Keith Wyness and myself, became the trustees of the financial trust, the Everton Collection Charitable Trust, and we set about putting the plans together to acquire the David France collection. Now, all the fans wanted the club to buy, and I can remember meeting you at a presentation we'd given, which was ridiculous. It was absolutely ridiculous, because the club had, well, they had 40% of the Everton collection anyway, and it was locked away in Gordon Locks, who was the club historian, in his back room. Yeah. Where, and Gordon had done a tremendous job in cataloguing a lot of the stuff that the club owned. But the club, a football club, there was that much stuff, the football club couldn't possibly handle it. So, when, you know, all that was up from the fans, it was daft, and that's why the Everton Collection Charitable Trust was a good solution, to the problem.
It must have been hard in those early days to convince the fans that it wasn't in the best interest of the collection to actually be purchased by Everton itself.
Was that one
of the hardest jobs?
Absolutely, that point was very hard, but it was also hard to get the fans to contribute. And I can remember we put together a plan for 9 months to get to the £1.5 million we needed, and I thought it would be quite easy. And I can remember the first game we mounted a collection, and initially we were going to put envelopes on all the seats. Which we couldn't do that because of health and safety. So we said, right, well, it's the Man United game. We'll get about £100,000. And we tried to get all these people to come and help us collect. We'd had all these T-shirts made. Obviously, it was in the programme. In the end of the day, I had to pay my own staff, and I had to pay them, to come to Goodison on the day to collect the money in big bins. Yeah. One of them was sexually assaulted. One of the girls was. And we raised the princely sum, no one knows this, of £350. So we were about £99,650 short of our target. But that brought home the fact that this is going to be a long job, and that we had to change because we just couldn't do it with PR alone. Which is why we extended and brought in a lot of people and formed a committee from the shareholders, season ticket holders, whoever we knew. We asked a lot of people, and a lot of people came and went. And I can remember two or three people who came for one meeting and said, no. Funnily enough, these are the people that had been shouting from the highest that the club should buy it. But when they saw the task that we had to raise the money, we never saw them again.
Because obviously you had to get money behind you for the lottery grant to kick in, didn't you?
Yeah.
You had to match that.
We did, and this is why Keith Wyness came in and his commitment. I mean, the club put £250,000 in. Lord Grantchester put £100,000 in. We were sitting in a meeting one day and he said, do you want a cheque for £100,000? I said, oh, thank you very much. And he gave me the cheque for the Everton Collection Charitable Trust. So that was 350. And we managed to raise 100,000 through various things that we were doing. And then the key thing was we decided our strategy was to have that Heritage Week. And we made some mistakes in there, but ostensibly it was the dinner where I think we raised £38,000. I can remember giving lots of stuff away. I'd had a painting of Dixie Dean that cost me £60 and we got £2,000 for that. So the dinner was good. I was very disappointed with the Everton-Barcelona game because we only got 7,000 people there. Barcelona turned round and said that was the biggest crowd they'd had for a former players game and they loved it. And then we had the exhibition, which was a resounding success, which is where I met you at
That's
the talk.
Right, yes.
And we'd done a film with Alan Ball, we'd done it. Dear Mike Hughes, I gave him the script, and he did the script. He read the script and sent it to me by email. Alan Ball, I phoned him up, and we went to his home in Farnworth, and his partner gave me a bacon and egg sandwich. And there's Bawley and I on the settee, and eating a bacon and egg sandwiches, and I was rubbing his knee, and I thought, I've arrived, this is Bawley. But he did this great film, if you recall. Yeah. And so the exhibition, David M. Robinson, the jewellers, gave us all the jewellery cases, and it was absolutely mobbed. From the day we opened the door till it finished, and we had to ask people to leave in the end because we were absolutely destroyed for the weekend. And that's when we knew that there was the desire. And probably that's when we'd actually achieved our ambition of conveying and educating Evertonia that the best solution was the trust for the Everton collection.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly remember the day that I went, and it was fantastic. You know, it was so well run, so well organised, and as you say, you just got this feeling of common purpose within the whole room.
Yeah.
So, were you always confident about getting that lottery fund
money? No. In the short term, our initial research said that we wouldn't get lottery funding. And then, as I said before, we'd done the PR campaign and failed miserably and naively thought, this is easy, we'll get money from Evertonia. And we approached high-worth Evertonians who gave us nothing. So those early days were bad. But then when we extended it, and that was the key to success, and we got a number of good guys in. We got David Stoker from the records office. And we got a guy called Jim Grissenthwaite, who was head of culture at Cumbria County Council. And it was Jim that came up with the solution that the best place for this collection is the Liverpool Records Office. And that's when we knew, when we came up with that solution. And it was Jim that said, well, I think you can go for lottery funding. So he introduced us to the lottery. And I think David Stoker and Jim Grissenthwaite were absolutely instrumental in us, and everyone else on the thing. But those two guys were instrumental in us getting lottery funding.
Yeah. These quiet men behind the scenes, isn't it?
Well, particularly David Stoker, because I think his father died just as he was doing the application. And the application is an immense thing. It must be 6 inches thick. And obviously my own firm did all the designs and the presentation of it, but dear old David wrote it, and I remember him phoning me up with about 4 days to go to say, I don't think I'm going to finish this. And I said, David, you've got to finish it. And by God, he did it, and he did a great job.
That must have been such a feeling of pride when you did secure the relief pride.
I'll tell you the day, because I'd been working down south, and I drove home, and I knew I was going to. I'd befriended the girl Nicola from the Heritage Lottery funding, and she was a Manchester United fan. But I knew she was on our side because I'd befriended her, and I knew she was going to do a good presentation for us to the lottery funding. And it was a hot day. I think it was July, and I had come home. And I'd come into my house, and I was by myself. And I got the phone call from Nicola, and she said, you've got the £1 million from the lottery to buy the collection. And I just broke down and cried. Yeah. And the first guy I called was Keith Wyness. And I said, Keith, we've done it. Yeah. And he said to me, Tony, you've single-handedly saved Everton's heritage. I'll never forget that. And then I phoned my mum and told her, and I said, Mum, I feel it's like when I passed my A levels. And she reminded me that I'd failed most of the A levels. But I was just so happy of what we'd achieved, and phoned all the team, and the team was great, from Freddie Peacock to Pauline Lappin. They'd contributed so much, everyone, Jim Buckley, all those people on the team. Gary Wilton was from Everton, still at Everton now. Just terrific Evertonians.
It's good to have that team spirit, isn't it?
Yeah. And I don't think they got the team, got the accolade that they should have, because, David France, if you look at it with a cold light of day, David France did a fabulous job in securing our heritage. Some of the stories he tells me about how he got it, and his wife gave him daggers. I mean, the last 10 volumes of the scriptures he paid £78,000 for. And fascinating. And how did they get out of Everton in the first place? There's another story. But David France, in a day when there was no internet, over a 27-year period, amassed this Everton collection. And the way he did it was were typical of the man, methodical, concentrated, focused. And he used to spend a day a week, and he'd have all these different people, before the internet, different people all over the world would phone him in Houston and say, we've got this. I'll have it, he said. And he used to buy, he used to always pay over the odds. So that was fabulous. But at the end of the day, we gave him $1.5 million. So he'd had 27 years of collecting stamps and then got $1.5 million for his stamp book. But if you think of the guys who then enabled David to get that reward, I don't think they didn't get the accolade from the fans that they should have done.
And do you think he's found it difficult to give up the collection?
Oh, God, I know he has. I know he has. But he wrote me a lovely letter, David, and he said, my work is now complete. And I thought that was great. That was a good sign-off. And I knew then that he was... I spoke to Elizabeth the other day because I was doing some research for a project on Everton. She said he'd just come out of hospital again when they were building a new house in Vancouver. So I thought, well, great, he must be enjoying life.
That's good to hear. Just away from the collection a touch, I know you've been heavily involved in kit launches for Everton, particularly over the last year and this year, particularly. I think the thing that's really... sticks in my mind is the pictures of Jagielka all over the place. Which you've got one in our hall while we're waiting for Stephen to come back to the university.
That was so funny.
What gave you that idea?
Well, it was Mark Rowan from Everton. We'd put our PR proposals. Everton brought us on board because obviously they've used my company for 5 years. And they brought us on board because they'd just got their new partner, Kitbag. And Kitbag didn't know me from Adam, never used PR before. And we put the proposals to Kitbag and to Everton. And Mark Rowan from Everton said, he didn't like this, didn't like that. And he said, listen. And his thinking was great because he said, what we need is we need to get a presence in the city centre. And we need somehow to get that new shirt all over the city centre. So we and he gave us the idea. But we came up with the creative back at the ranch, back at the office. And we said, right, well, we'll put cardboard cutouts of Jagielka all around the city. I always remember the funniest thing was we'd said to the Adelphi Hotel, we phoned up their marketing manager and said, listen, can we put a cardboard cutout of Jagielka? And he said, yes, sure. So went along and I took the cardboard cutout and I said, right, here he is, can we put him on the front? He said, yeah, put him there, no problem. He said, don't worry, we'll take care of him. And I said, no, we don't want you to take care of him, because obviously we'd gone to Blue Kipper, the fantastic Everton website, and they'd done a competition to have the best photograph with the Jagielka cutout. And by God, that was a great viral marketing campaign, because we had photographs of Jagielka in Benidorm, boarding an EasyJet flight on the gates of Anfield, on Formby Beach. It was fabulous. And I'll never forget that day, because we put 120 cutouts around the city. And of course, Jagielka lives about 50 yards from me. And the last one I had in the car, and I drove up to his house, knocked on the door, and said, I've just put 120 of these up in Liverpool, do you want one? And he said, yeah. It's hilarious.
So he didn't know anything about
it? No, he didn't know anything about it. Anyway, then he phoned me up and asked me for another one.
Great stuff. With your history of PR and corporate world, did you have any input into naming the store in the middle of town, Everton One?
I'd love to say I did, and I've told everyone I did, and I didn't.
Because it sounds like it's straight out of your box. You know.
Yeah, someone actually mentioned it within one of our meetings. They actually said, why don't we call it Everton 1 and Everton 2, and then our address can be Everton 2, Liverpool 1. But and I'm convinced someone did mention it in our meeting. But I think where it came from was a Kitbag meeting with the creative agency Photolink in Manchester, and one of the creatives from the agency came up with Everton 1 and Everton 2 at Liverpool 1. And I hate to say it, I know the guy, and I think he's a red.
All's fair in love and business.
But I have claimed it. I have claimed it.
Rightly so. Rightly so. Going on to the club in a wider aspect, am I right in thinking that at one point you were thinking of buying into the club?
Oh, yeah. 1993. I had a PR company called Greenwood Tie Public Relations, and I'd sold it to a big French advertising agency called Euro RSCG for 1.6 million quid. And I was stuck at home, and I heard on the radio that the Moores family had said there's no truth in the rumour that Everton's for sale. So I immediately phoned up a fellow called Alec Craig, who was a senior partner at Halliwell's in Manchester, and I said, how do I buy Everton with someone else's money? And he responded, said, well, do you know any Evertonians? So I phoned up, who are big wealth. Yes. So I phoned up Mike Dybble, who was head of Bowden, Dybble and Hayes, huge Manchester agency, and was marketing director of Manchester Olympic bid at the time. I phoned up Arthur Abercrombie from Stirling, who eventually became a director of Everton. And I knew he was a wealthy individual. And Arthur and I went down to see Bill Kenwright and say, listen, we think Everton's up for sale and we'd like to form a consortium. And Bill Kenwright said, no, you're too naive, boys, and sent us packing. And 2 weeks later, he phoned us up and said, I think you're that right, lads. Let's do it. So we got together. And then we were joined by this nutty professor called Tom Cannon, who is one of my greatest friends. I love him dearly. And he's as nutty an Evertonian as myself. And we became the Everton Consortium. And we were all putting our own money in. And we'd agreed a deal with the Moores family to buy Everton for £5 million. And then Peter Johnson came along and offered £10 million. And we thought, well, hang on, we're scrimping and scraping to put £5 million together, because we were going to do a rights issue. And Peter Johnson came along and said, if it needs another 10, I'll put another 10 in. And we thought, well, hang on, he's a multi-millionaire. This is who we need to get Everton back to where it is. So we all backed down.
Right.
And then obviously Bill Kenwright stayed on the board, and Arthur Abercrombie was invited to go on the board. Because at the time, my one ambition was to be a director of Everton Football Club. I wouldn't thank you for it now. but at the time, I was 42, quite a young thruster, and that was one of my ambitions.
How far away do you think you were from getting onto that board? Looking back, it's difficult to say.
It's probably, yeah. I mean, Bill Kenwright stood up once at an AGM and said, if the Everton board would be different if we'd have got it, and we would have had Tom Cannon and Tony Tye on the board. Yeah. Well, he actually said that at an AGM, which was nice.
Yeah.
But I was on a couple of boards. I was on an AHS Trust board, and obviously on the board of my golf club, and on the board of the three companies I had at the time. So it's the last thing I'd want now.
Which brings me quite neatly into club ownership. There's a lot of people, and if you read the message boards, a lot of people are very critical about Bill Kenwright. I'm not one of them. But people say they want the big bucks coming in, you know, the shaky monies. What's your feeling?
Well, that's an easy solution. Mm. Find a shake, and you end up like a Manchester City, with no soul, no team spirit, just highly paid guys who got no loyalty to you. Now, I know the modern day footballer, as one of our ex-players who went to Manchester City, and I don't blame him, because he's on 35 grand a week and then he goes to them for 90 grand a week. We'd all do it. But there's no loyalty anymore. But I think Everton is one of the few clubs where, I was talking to Leon Osman last week at the away shirt launch, and his heart and soul is in Everton. Mm-hmm. And we've got, you know, Jack Rodwell, who's just signed and committed himself to the future. We have got, you know, Tony Hibbert. We've got Scousers, and we've got Aussies and Spaniards. who are also Evertonians. Mm-hmm. So I believe that we're as near to Dammit as a loyal Everton group as you could get, but I wouldn't want to be in Manchester City. Yeah. And Bill has kept that. And he's taken his sticks that we can't compete. But the manager he's brought in, you know, sometimes I don't like his style, but by God, he's a genius at bringing players in and having the Howard Kendall team spirit. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've got. Yeah. I can't wait for next season.
Be nice with an unencumbered squad.
Yeah.
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 Now, your heart and soul is a PR man. Do you think football's too much hype over substance?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've all enjoyed the Sky coverage and what that's brought. But I'm a great believer that life is all about cycles. And I'm just waiting for the bubble to burst and we go back to what it was in the... Well, I don't think it'll go back to where it was in the 60s where, you know... I remember going to see Johnny Morrissey, who used to live in a council house in Aintree Lane. I'm sure it will not... The cookie has got to burst, you know, the bubble has got to burst. It is overhyped, and I just think they're on too much money. Mm-hmm. End of story.
Yeah. Merging in what we've been talking about here, you can walk into that record office and take one piece from the Everton collection. What would you take?
Without a doubt, it would be probably a lot of people's favourite would be the medal from 1891.
Yeah.
Because it signifies a couple of things. I'm very proud of Everton firsts. And that was an Everton first. And we've all seen the big lists, you know, from first underground heating to first floodlights to first match day programme, first team with numbers, first team on the 11th of July 1913 to have a reigning monarch visit the ground. And that medal was at the instigation of the Everton board, because we'd won the championship in 1891 and all the Football League used to give you was a flag, and the Everton board commissioned the medals. And it was an 8-starred medal, which every player in the squad on the team got for winning the championship. And thereafter, the Football League followed suit. So from 1891, the Football League supplied the medals. But the key thing on that medal was a live bird in the centre.
Yeah.
Because in 1891, there was no such thing as Liverpool Football Club.
Yeah.
And that just shows that Everton had not only been first, but was the first major football club in this city.
And it's a tale we've got to get out.
Yeah.
Have you got an Everton story you'd like to talk about? Any something that you think other people may not know? Things that... fact or story or...
I did have, but it was Keith Wynes. It was all about Keith Wynes.
I know we've gone over an awful lot of things that other people just wouldn't have had access to, the access that you've had.
Yeah.
So let's finish it off with a nice, simple question. What does Everton mean to you?
Everything. I well up. I'm like Bobby Charlton when I think of Everton. It's Everton's been my life.
Yeah.
You know, going to Goodison Park, walking down that road. I can remember going with my granddad regularly when I was 19. I used to go with him. He used to go with his brother Harry, and his brother Harry died in Bullens Road when Joe Royal was about to take a penalty against Manchester United.
Yeah.
My Uncle Harry died, had a heart attack. And the policeman that was called was my best pal, Alan Carver.
Oh.
So Everton has been my life. My mother is, just like her father, the most biased Everton supporter. And 2 weeks ago, she was 80. And I shouldn't be saying this, but I phoned her up and said, "Happy birthday, Mum. How are you?" She said, "I'm marvellous. And I'm having such a lovely day. And it's just been announced that Liverpool are £400 million in debt. And I couldn't be happier."
That's a great way to end the story. Thank you very much indeed, Tony.
Pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Pete.
Cheers.